5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
All engines running. Commit. Liftoff.
Hey, good afternoon and welcome to SWAT Radio. This is Doug McCary of His Light Ministries, and it is Thursday, April 4th. Hard to believe we're already into April 2024, but I'm so glad that you're joining us today. If you know anybody who has talked about all the things going on with men in our culture, if you know anybody that's struggling with men in our culture, if you know anybody that wants to talk about maybe the role of men and women, and you get into these discussions at church or wherever, today's the day you want to get them to listen to SWAT Radio. And whether you're in Mississippi, Florida, Georgia, Virginia, wherever, or listening through our app, we have Nancy Piercy today, Professor Nancy Piercy, who is the author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. She's also written numerous other books and articles, Total Truth, Finding Truth. She's a professor now and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University, and has been featured in Newsweek, The New Yorker, and is considered one of the top five women apologists by Christianity Today. I always wonder how they come up with those. Like, for today, we're going to say she is the top apologist today in women's apologists in the U.S. We're happy to have her on, and she's certainly done a lot of work here, and she's got a fascinating story, and I'm looking forward to having her on. Professor Piercy, welcome to SWAT Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes. That quote, you know, when everybody says this is the top, one of the top evangelicals, apologist, explain what that is, word is, because some listeners may not know what it means to be an apologist.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so it just means mastering arguments for the existence of God, learning how to respond to objections and questions. And, you know, for me, it was a big part of my conversion to Christianity, because I was very steeped in secular worldviews, secular philosophies. And so I really had to work through, how do I know Christianity is true? You know, what are the good reasons and arguments? And how does it stand up against all of these secular isms? And so that's really all it is. If somebody says, why are you a Christian, and you give them reasons, you've just been an apologist.
Yes. Well, I was sharing with you before we came on air about doing ministry in Russia. And over in Russia, I dealt with a lot of atheists. And I went into the university setting. I went into government settings and had conversations. And one of the things that kept coming back through all of the responses to when I would try to talk about Jesus is, you really expect me to believe that's so simple, that I can do anything, I can kill anybody, and then just say, I'm sorry, I believe in Jesus. Did you encounter that, or did you have that feeling when you were going through your atheistic cycle or your agnostic cycle? You know, that this is just, it's too ridiculous to be true, kind of a thought?
Well, it was more a matter of, so I was raised in a Christian home. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know this, but all Scandinavians are Lutheran.
So I did not know
my
that.
My parents were Scandinavian.
Okay.
It's kind of like all Irish or Catholic.
Right? Well, that's right.
Yeah. It was the state church. And so at any rate, it was a very ethnic kind of Christianity, which means there was not a lot of personal reality in our home. And when I became, a high school student, I'm attending a public high school, all my textbooks, all my teachers are secular. And I just started asking, how do we know Christianity is true? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's about it. Over against all of these secular things I'm being taught in my classroom, how do I know Christianity is true? And unfortunately, none of the adults in my life could answer me, give me any answer. So I talked to a Christian college professor. I said, point blank, why are you a Christian? He said, works for me.
Wow.
That's it.
That's not helpful, is it?
That's not apologetics, is it?
No.
that's not a reason. And then I talked to a seminary dean, and I thought I would get something more substantial. And all he said was, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes. Like, it was a psychological phase. And so about halfway through high school, I realized I don't have any good reasons for believing this. And it seemed to me a matter of intellectual honesty that if you don't have reasons for something, you shouldn't believe it, mm-hmm. whether it's Christianity or anything else. And so that's when I walked away from my Christian upbringing very intentionally. Mm-hmm. And I decided, I guess it's up to me to figure out what is truth. Mm-hmm. And I literally thought, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to survey all the religions and all the philosophies that are out there and decide for myself what is true. Mm-hmm. But I pretty quickly realized if there's no God, then there's no meaning to life. There's no purpose. There's no foundation for ethics. It's just true for me, true for you. There's not even a foundation for knowledge. I mean, if all I have is my puny brain and the vast scope of time and space, what makes me think I could have some sort of transcendent universal truth? Ridiculous. That's how it seemed to me at the time. So yeah, when I graduated from high school, I was a complete relativist, skeptic. I'd even accepted determinism. You know, there's no free will because my biology classes taught me we're just complex biochemical machines. And so I had absorbed all of these secular isms. And it was a couple of years later, I'd gone back to Europe. We'd lived in Europe when I was a child. And so I loved it. I'd saved my money all through high school so I could go back.
Well that's what all high school and college students want to do, don't they? Don't they want to go to Europe? So.
And my high school job was playing the violin in the symphony orchestra. So that's how I earned my money to go back to Europe.
Wow.
But that's how I stumbled across the ministry of Francis Schaeffer. And he's known for having an apologetics ministry. It was in Switzerland. It's called L'Abri, which is French for the shelter. Mm-hmm. And that's where I first encountered apologetics, you know, people who could actually give you good reasons and arguments and who could engage with all of those secular isms and could show that Christianity had a better answer. So I was really blown away. I had no idea Christianity could be supported by good reasons and arguments. And it took a while. It took a year and a half because I was kind of stubborn about it. I did not want to go back to the religion of my childhood. So I really fought for a long time. But after about a year and a half, I did become a Christian through apologetics. That's why what I teach now at Houston Christian University is apologetics. Mm-hmm. All my books have something to do with apologetics, you know, with defending Christian truth in a secular age. And even this book on masculinity, the whole point is to ask, why does the secular world get masculinity so wrong? Mm-hmm. You know, and how can we propose a biblical worldview instead?
Well, and it's all turned upside down, and I do want to get into it. I just want to ask you one question real quick. Could you share just a little bit about your personal experience with Dr. Schaeffer? I've never met anybody that was really one-on-one with him or talk. What was he like?
He was real. Yeah. He was authentic. I met my husband at L'Abri, and we agree that among all the, you know, over time you do meet a fair number of Christian celebrities here and there.
Yeah.
And among all of the celebrities that we've ever known, Schaeffer is the one who stands out to my husband and me, as the most authentic, the most real, the most personable. L'Abri was a place where people came and actually lived. And and that happened very organically. Mm-hmm. Schaeffer was just so good as an evangelist. And when his daughters got old enough to go down the mountain to the university, you know, they would talk to their friends about God, and the friends would ask questions, and they'd say, well, you should talk to my dad. He's really good with questions like that. And since they lived in such a remote part of the Swiss Alps, the students would take that little train up the mountain and spend the whole weekend. Mm. And then they would tell their friends, and another group would come up the next weekend. And then, you know, another group, until the Schaeffers had students sleeping all over the hallways and the couches and the balconies. And it grew very organically into a place where people would come and actually watch how Christians live. Mm-hmm. You know, you weren't just getting this head knowledge, this apologetics, you know, the good arguments. I mean, that's important. That was part of it. But you also saw a quality of Christian community that many of us, I would say this for myself too, I had never seen Christians exhibit such a quality of love. And so that was part of what persuaded a lot of people to become Christians. L'Abri grew as other people said, well, often it was people who converted through Liberty, they would say, we'd like to join this ministry. So they would buy a house down the street, you know, and then someone else would buy a house across, you know, across town. It was a tiny Swiss village.
Yeah.
And so what you did is you actually lived with a family. You lived with a Christian family. There was nothing that was not institutional. It was very personal.
And it was almost like it was like a Beitav in Israel, wasn't it? Like a, you know how the old Beitav, they called them the Beitav, the little communities. It was how the families would be in one community, which is really, isn't that what the church is supposed to be? Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but isn't that what the church is supposed to be?
Oh, yes. There were so many people who came back from Libri saying, we need to do this. Somehow we need to do this kind of community again. And I don't think anyone's quite pulled it off. But I agree with you. That kind of intentional community, I think, is what the church is meant to be.
Yeah, it is. Well, I want to go into a little bit of your own journey, because in the Toxic War on Masculinity, you don't write this as somebody who just did research, brought data, and start making, you know, these different principled truths out there for a people to live by. You did research, but you also had your own personal journey of dealing with a man who had some toxicity to his masculinity, and you talk about that in the book. Can you share with our listeners a little bit about your own journey of faith in that regard, not just the atheist or agnostic part, but you kind of grew up with an abusive dad who everybody else thought was great. And can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, everyone else thought was great. I say that there's a kind of a public father and a private father, because he was a very successful university professor. But then he would come home and he would beat his kids. He was severely physically abusive. He wouldn't say, do this, I'll spank you. He'd say, do this, I'll beat you. And he's quite open about it. Mm. And then he would. He would use his fists, you know. He would punch us and kick us. And so, not surprisingly, that was another reason I left my faith in high school.
Yeah.
Is because whatever my parents were, I did not want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I ricocheted off into very extreme feminism for several years because of my father's abuse, and read all the foundational books on feminism. I always had some feminist book on my bedside table. And then eventually I became a Christian, as I mentioned, and I had to sort of rethink this whole question. In the introduction to the book, I say, in a sense, I've been writing this book my whole life.
Yeah.
And I was interviewed by a Christian psychologist. And he said, well, at least we know you're not writing from an ivory tower.
Yeah.
You know, you're writing from the trenches. Because, yeah, this is hard won knowledge. This was not easy for me. As you probably know, when you have such severe trauma, it takes years and years of psychological and spiritual healing, which did also start when I was a Christian, by the way. There was a psychiatric social worker on staff at Labri. And she met with me the whole time I was there and helped me to realize that I couldn't just walk away from my childhood. I had thought that when I became an adult and left home, I was just going to leave all that behind. I was going to build my life over again from scratch. And I learned, no, you can't do that. You have to actually invite the Lord into those wounded parts of yourself.
Mm.
And that, you know, the most powerful healing is just God's love. You have to sort of fight your way to that kind of experience, but you have to work on it. You have to pray through it. And when you have an experience of God's love, that's the ultimate healing. God's love heals. I mean, we know that from human relationships too, right? A loving relationship can be very healing. But God's love is the ultimate healing. And so that's what I've come to experience over many, many years, is the healing that comes from just having a close, warm, real relationship with God.
What would you say to maybe a listener that's out there now that might be struggling with that? I mean, at a place where you were prior to Labri, you know, they may not find a Labri here. Unfortunately, I don't know of many places like that here. And just like we were alluding to earlier, what would you say to that person? We know they got to go to God. That's the only place that healing takes place. But that person who's out there right here, right now, they've been in an abusive relationship, whether it's a spouse or a father or a parent, a mother, whatever, and they're hurting and they don't know what to do. You've been there. Can you give them any kind of insight to maybe a place they can go or a place they can direct some of that to try to get healing from the Lord right now?
Well, certainly finding a person who can give you the experience of unconditional love is very helpful. Like the psychiatric social worker at La Brie. Her name was Sheila Bird, and we called her Birdie. But she gave me that kind of unconditional love that I had not ever received from my family. And, you know, I could just keep fighting on, you know, pouring out all this pain and, you know, all my troubled emotions. And she would just keep loving me. Mm-hmm. And I'd never known anyone like that before. So when I left La Brie, I had at least one image of real love. In fact, for at least the first year, maybe longer, when I prayed to God, I kind of imagined talking to Birdie.
Really?
Yeah, Birdie was my image of, oh, how do you talk to God? You talk to God the way you would talk to Birdie, because I could talk to Birdie knowing she loved me, knowing I could be totally honest with her. Things that nobody else wants to hear. I mean, let's face it, not everybody wants to bear your burdens. A lot of people really don't want to fight with you, you know, through these emotional battles that you go through. So the best thing is if you can find somebody who loves you enough to do that. The second best thing is there are good books on the subject. And I did not find, when I came back to the States, I looked for other therapists, and I never found one that was quite, well, nobody as good as Birdie. I never found one that was all that helpful. So books became my therapist. You know, you might not be able to find somebody who's local, you know, who you can talk to. But books give you access to people all around the world mm-hmm. who have written on, you know, the spiritual life and how to attain emotional and psychological healing. And so books were my second best. I really did learn a lot just from reading books on emotional healing, mm-hmm. Reading books on you know, a Christian approach to psychology, learning some of the more typical psychological patterns that are the product of abuse and how to work through them. So books are a really good resource.
Is there a book that just stands out to you that would be a good starter book? I mean, I know I didn't prep you on this. This is just off the cuff, but I wonder, is there something that just you think of or a book off that? If not, that's okay. I just wondered if there was one that really sticks in your mind as a, like, you know, a good book that would help.
Yeah. Well, in my book, Toxic War and Masculinity, I do have two chapters on abuse. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just slip that under the carpet. And so a lot of people were surprised when they got to the end of the book. They didn't know I was going to deal with that subject. But in that chapter, I found all the best resources that are currently available
okay.
on issues of abuse, and not just Christian, you know, some very, very good secular writers as well, psychotherapists. And almost everybody there that's in the end notes, you know, if you want a good starting place, go read the end notes, because yeah. there's some very good people.
Well, you do deal with that in there, which I was going to bring that up too, that even starting with that and maybe skip ahead, you can just go to that chapter on abuse. Right. I mean, and read about that.
Yes. And since you have a ministry to men in particular, I will mention one. I'm trying to think on my feet here. What are some of my favorites? But there is he's a secular psychotherapist, but he wrote the first book on male depression.
Okay.
And so he's considered sort of an expert on male psychology. And the book is called "I Don't Want to Talk About It."
Oh, that sounds
which
good.
Seems an appropriate title.
Yeah.
And his name is Terrence Real, R-E-A-L.
Okay.
And you can look at his website. His website is just terryreal.com, terryreal.com.
What a cool name.
And he's
I like that name.
And he now does couples counseling, and he takes only very, very troubled marriages. He won't even take you unless you've been through three or four counselors already. And he's so successful that he's been featured on Oprah and 2020 and NBC and all these major news programs, because they're like, how do you do this? Mm. Why are you so successful? So I have found here, since you have a ministry to men in particular, I thought maybe mentioning him because his specialty is male psychology.
And that book, again, is I Don't Want to Talk About It. Terry Real, R-E-A-L.
I don't want to talk about it.
I'm assuming you can get that on Amazon as well, just as well as The Toxic War on Masculinity. Again, we're talking to Professor Nancy Piercy on her new book, The Toxic. It's really not that new, but it is. I mean, it's fairly new. It's out there. The Toxic War on Masculinity. I was talking to a guy today who said his dad gave it to him and he still hadn't read it. And I said, you need to read it. You need to read it. He was a younger guy, and I just said, you need to read this book. I wish I would have read it 20 years ago, actually 30 years ago, because it's good in that you talk about even how our culture defines masculinity and how that influences us, and it has. And one of the things that struck me, Nancy, is the Industrial Revolution, how that impacted manhood. Or our view of manhood, and even the home. And I learned things in there that, I mean, I'm a history major. I love history. I love reading history. And I didn't even realize about the whole vote thing, about how the biggest people who were against women voting were women who wanted the men to vote part of their home. So I learned these things in your book. Talk a little bit about that about how we're being torn as men between what the culture says manhood looks like and what the Bible says manhood looks like. Can you do that for a second?
Yeah. Well, there's a sociological study that looked at just that question, and I put it right at the front of the book. And the reason I did it is that this has proven to be the most controversial book I have ever written, which surprised me because my previous book was on homosexuality, transgenderism, abortion. The title is Love Thy Body. And I really thought that would be it. But this book, what I do with all my books is I do a lot of reading groups to sort of get feedback. And when my reading groups told their friends and family we were going through a manuscript on masculinity, invariably the first question was, whose side is she on? with that tone.
Yeah, very typical.
And, well, I mean, men tended to assume a woman writing a book on the subject was a male-bashing feminist, and more progressive types tended to assume I was sort of a angry culture warrior, a red pill type. So I put this study right at the beginning to overcome that initial suspicion. And this is he's not a Christian, but he's very well known in his field, and he gets invited to speak all around the world. And so he came up with a very clever experiment, where he asks young men themselves two questions. The first one is, what does it mean to be a good man? If I say, he was a good man, at a eulogy, somebody says that, what does it mean? And all around the world, he said, young men had no trouble answering that. They would immediately start listing things like duty, honor, integrity, sacrifice, do the right thing, look out for the little guy, be a provider, be a protector, be responsible. And the sociologists would say, where'd you learn that? And they'd say, I don't know. It's just in the air we breathe. And in other words, it is universal. Mm-hmm. We would say it's because men are made in God's image. And they do know that their unique masculine strengths are not given them just to get whatever they want, but to take care of, to provide, to protect those that they love. But then he would follow up with a second question. And he'd say, what does it mean if I say to you, man up, be a real man? And the young men themselves would say, oh, no, that's completely different. That means be tough, never show weakness, win at all costs, suck it up, play through pain, be competitive, get rich, get laid, using their language there. And so the sociologists concluded that men are, in fact, trapped between these two competing scripts, that they do have this inherent universal knowledge of what it means to be the good man. They're made in God's image. We could call this general revelation, right? There's things that people know about God apart from Scripture, because these were not countries with a Christian background. But then they also feel a cultural pressure to live up to a script that's quite different. Right. That I mean, it's not all bad. Like, we want people to be tough in a crisis, But if it's disconnected from the moral ideal of the good man, then it can slide into traits we consider more toxic, like entitlement and dominance and control and so on. And so this really does give us a better way to approach these issues, because most men don't respond well to being called toxic, right? Yeah. Nobody would.
Yeah.
And so I would like to see us think through, how can we encourage and support and affirm men in that innate knowledge of what it means to be a good man, you know, which is universal.
Mm-hmm.
You can count on it being there in whoever you're talking to. And that would give us a much more positive way to approach people on these issues.
Well, I was struck when I was reading the book about the Industrial Revolution impact on men. I hadn't really thought about it. I grew up in the South, you know, in the South that we, you know, there were big families, people gardened, or they worked, you know, their gardens or whatever. And you just did work around the house. But thinking about it, even from what you shared in the book about how men, they believed in the common good of everybody. They were working for the common good. It wasn't individualistic. Speak to that. We got about 2 minutes before our break for the news. Speak to that real quick about the common, thinking of the common good versus the individual good that the Industrial Revolution brought about.
Good. I'll try to cover as much as I can. 2 minutes.
And we can come back after the break. So.
Right. At any rate, before the Industrial Revolution, like you were saying, men worked side by side with their wives and children all day on the family farm, the family industry, the family business. And so the social expectation on men focused much more on their caretaking role. It was not an individualistic culture, like you say. Even the concept of authority itself was defined as, you're the one who's responsible for the common good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you're not supposed to be looking out for your own interests, but for the common good of the whole, whether that's the family or, say, the church and so on, civil society. And so the very definition of masculinity had baked into it this notion of self-sacrifice for the common good. Mm-hmm. And so then the question is, how did we lose that? Mm-hmm. Well, the Industrial Revolution took work out of the home. Men had to follow their work out of the home into offices and factories. And for the first time in American history, they were not working with people they loved and had a moral bond with. They were working as individuals in competition with other men. And you can imagine that's a very different environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we first start to see the literature change. People began to protest that men were losing that caretaking ethos, that they were becoming self-interested, egocentric, you know, ambitious, greedy, and acquisitive, to mm-hmm. use the language of the day,
yeah.
and even turning their job into an idol.
Mm.
So that's you know, if you want to know where the concept of toxic masculinity came from, you can't just go back to the 60s and maybe second wave feminism. You have to go all the way back to the Industrial Revolution. I was very surprised to read the language there. It was very negative. It was very critical, almost as critical as what we see today.
Yeah, it struck me. I was surprised. When we come back, I want to delve into, how has this impacted the church from your perspective? This individualistic approach, we certainly see it. And talking a little bit about the public-private divide, you know, between the public man, private man that you experienced with your dad, but we see in our celebrity culture as well, of social media and everything else. So when we come back from the break, you're listening to SWAT Radio. We're talking to Professor Nancy Piercy. We'll be right back after the news. Stay tuned.
I pull, go back and forth, finding myself pounding on a locked door. I try to make it out alone without your help, but I know I never win this war. I can never be free without you. I can never be me without you.
Hey, welcome back to SWAT Radio. This is Doug McCary of His Light Ministries. Hey, I want to give a quick shout out to our listeners in Meridian, Mississippi, listening on WMER and WMOX there, and also to those listening in Virginia on the Lighthouse, and up in Folkestone, Georgia, down in St. Augustine, and here in Jacksonville. This is a live daily radio program. SWAT stands for Spiritual Warriors Advancing Truth. And I'm so grateful that we have Professor Nancy Piercy on today talking about her book, The Toxic War on Masculinity. And if you want to share this or listen to it again, you just go to SWATradio.com. It'll be posted tonight. And you can share that. I highly encourage you to do that. And you can get her book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, on Amazon.com. She has many others. This is a great read. If you're a guy, you need to read it. If you're a woman, you need to read it because it's good. It really goes through what's going on in our culture and why this issue is important. And she does get into, we talked about last segment, a couple of chapters on even dealing with abuse. And there, you know, there's a perception out there, Nancy, that that Christian men are just, they're patriarchal, bigoted, mean-spirited, abusive men. How does that really pan out with the research that you've come across? You talk about it in your book. Should go into that just a little bit about that perception out there on media and everywhere else and social media. Talk a little bit about perception versus reality with Christian, not professing Christian, but real Christian men.
Right. So I was very surprised when I ran across this data. I had to go digging in the academic literature to find it because it's not out there. But what happened is, you know, the cultural narrative, of course, is that Christian men are, if anything, exhibit A of toxic masculinity. I'll give you just one example. I found lots, but this one is the co-founder of the Me Too, the Church Too movement, which followed the Me Too movement.
Yeah. Okay.
And she said, the theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened is the social scientists were listening to these accusations and saying, where's your evidence? You're making these charges, but where's your data? And they went out and did the studies. And I quote a dozen or so different studies that all found that actually committed church-going evangelical Christian men test out as the most loving husbands and fathers. Their wives report the highest level of happiness. And yes, they do interview the wives separately, which is important.
Yeah, it is.
Evangelical fathers spend more time with their children, 3.5 hours more per week than secular fathers.
Folks, I'm so sorry. We just had a little bit of a glitch in the interview, and I need to restart this Zoom. So again, we're talking with Nancy Piercy, and the book is The Toxic War on Masculinity. And all of a sudden, it just froze. So I'm going to try to get her back on here. Hey, welcome back to SWAT Radio. We got Nancy back. Can you hear me, Nancy?
I can, yes. I'm not sure how I lost you, but yes, I'm back.
Okay. I was trying to call your phone. Michael gave me your number, and I couldn't reach you, and I was like, I didn't know if your phone died, but thank you for jumping back on here. Sorry, whatever the glitch was. Obviously, this topic... It's something that we need to deal with, and I was glad to be able to get you back. The Toxic War on Masculinity is the name of her book, Professor Nancy Piercy. You can get it on Amazon.com. And we were talking, we went into just talking about the toxic masculinity and what else? I don't even know. I'm been so concerned trying to get you back on. Let's just take it from the men, real men. Oh, I know where we were. Real studies. We were talking about the social studies you did about how the stereotypical Christian men are terrible. They're toxic, and you just started into that and it cut. So can you go back over that a little bit? That social study data.
Right. Well, Right. So these are studies done by sociologists and psychologists, and they found that committed Christian men who attend church regularly actually test out as the most loving husbands and fathers. And before we got lost, I mentioned some of the numbers, but let me give you a final quote to pull it all together. This was the sociologist who did the largest study, and his name is Brad Wilcox. He's at the University of Virginia. And to give you a sense of his stature, he writes for places like the New York Times. And so this is a quote from a New York Times article. He said, direct quote, "It turns out that the happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives."
Wow.
Fully 73% of women who hold conservative gender values and attend church regularly with their husbands have high quality marriages. So the sociological data has completely debunked the secular narrative about Christian men. And I have to tell you, we need to get this into the churches to start with, to encourage Christian men. And then we need to use it also into the public arena. It's not a pep talk from a religious leader. You know, it's solid empirical research. It's data, it's findings that we should be confident in bringing out into the public.
Yeah, that's right. And I was going to follow up with you by asking even what you've seen. You're a professor, right? So you're teaching at a Christian university. And how has this cultural view of toxic masculinity impacted the church from your perspective?
Yeah, well, when I told my class that I was writing a book on masculinity, one of my male students shot back, "What masculinity? It's been beaten out of us." And so that took me aback a bit. Okay, so it's in the church too. And one of my graduate students was the ministry head of the large Christian ministry at a Baptist church, the women's ministry. And she said, "On Mother's Day, we hand out roses and tell the women they're wonderful. On Father's Day, we scold the men." And
I'm trying to see if I can get you back on here. While I'm doing that, Toxic War on Masculinity is available on Amazon. It is a great book for anybody to read, man or women. It doesn't matter. It deals with the whole subject of what our culture is saying. And for some reason, I'm not sure what is going on because her screen keeps freezing, but I will let you know that this book by Professor Piercy is something that they gave out at the Shepherd's Conference. And the Shepherd's Conference had 5,000 plus men there that were there to hear about how truth triumphs. And Professor Piercy talks about the truth about biblical masculinity in this book. And I highly encourage it. Again, you can go to Amazon.com. Just reading it myself as I went through and have been reading it, one of the things she discussed in there was the whole issue of roles of men and women and what submission. We hear a lot within the church of submission. We hear a lot within the church of male headship, and she does such a great job in there of dealing with those issues from a very biblical point of view. It is a good book. Professor Piercy talks a lot in there about the roles of men and women, how they're equal but different. And she uses the term first among equals. I was going to ask her about that and was hoping to be able to get her to kind of go into that. Well, I was just talking about the roles of men and women. You use a phrase, I don't know if it was original with you, first among equals, but you do such a good job. Talk a little bit about how even that, the roles God gave us as men and women has been impacted by this toxic view of masculinity our culture has pushed, saying Christian men just want to lord it over. And in some ways, some men buy into that in the church, but you talk about that first among equals aspect of men and women. Technology not cooperating today, guys. I am so sorry, because it is so good what she's talking about. This, maybe God just wants everybody to go buy the book, Jeremy, I think. I don't know. My wife is texting me. She says, just give up, Doug, give up. I probably need to. But I don't give up, Jeremy. I keep fighting through. Anyway, in this book, where she talks about marriage, I want to read from it. And since we're having problems, just listen to this. And I was thinking specifically, I was going to ask her about this whole idea of marriage, that the difference between a contract and a covenant, both are agreements, but the difference between them are crucial. A contract defines an exchange of goods and services, but a covenant defines a moral relationship between persons. In a contract, I seek my own interest. I strike a deal. But in a covenant, I seek the common good of relationships and everyone in it.
Yes, am I back on?
Yes, you are. I can hear you.
Am I back on?
Yes, you are.
Good, good, good. Oh, that's such a good observation. Yes, I totally agree with you. I spend a fair amount of time explaining where this contract idea even came from, because there's a name for it. It's called social contract theory. Yeah. And it has really taken over American society as a whole. And I agree with you. It's taken over a lot of Christians' understanding of marriage. You know, we used to think marriage was an entity that God defined, right? Here's how people used to think of the common good. There's the good for me and there's the good for you. And then there's the common good, and that's the good for the relationship. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to young dating couples, they always get this. I say to them, there's me, there's you, and there's our relationship. Mm. And they understand the relationship is different. And so that's what...
Well, once again, we get into a thing. We will figure this out. I don't know if it's on our end or her end. I just made her the host to try to get this thing going, but... unfortunately, we're almost out of time, and I've already asked her if she would come back on, and I am going to make a commitment to try to run this down to make sure this doesn't happen. But unfortunately, when you deal with technology, these kind of things do happen. But I want to remind you again, the toxic war on masculinity, how Christianity reconciles the sexes. Nancy Piercy, listen, she's written Total Truth. She's written Finding Truth. She's written a lot of good books. I really believe for where we are right now as a country, the toxic war on masculinity is a good book for you to read right now. So I highly encourage you, come in and go to Amazon.com. Oh, Dr. Piercy, I know I can see you now. I'm so sorry. I don't know what's happening. This is just, unfortunately, when you deal with technology, you deal with this kind of thing. But I just want people to know that I think this is a must read. If you're a pastor, must read. If you're anybody who's a leader in the church, but even for just men and women, it's a must read relationally. It gives you a lot of good information that encourages you as men, and even for women, it's very encouraging to read through this. And last question, how can we pray for you?
Well, right now we need to pray for my Zoom connection, yeah. So this doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
I really have not had this happen before. So, but you know, I just would appreciate your praying for the people who are being impacted by the book, because when I talk to people like you, I just have such a sense of how God is using the book, to reach out to men in particular, because men, you know, they really feel the attacks on masculinity, even in the church. I just heard from a former graduate student of mine who now teaches high school. Mm-hmm. And she said, all of my students are fans of Andrew Tate.
Andrew.
And even Christian. And I said, where do you teach? She said, at a classical Christian school.
Wow.
So even young men, if we're not giving them a biblical view of masculinity, they will be drawn to these online influences like Andrew Tate.
Yes.
And so that's the urgency here.
Well, we will pray for that. I want to have you on where we have better technology. But anyway, thank you for joining us. Hey, you can listen to this or any past broadcast. Go to Amazon.com, get the book, Toxic War on Masculinity. Thank you, Professor Piercy. And we'll be back tomorrow with SWAT Radio.